The determination of the chromatic number of Euclidean space is a long-standing problem. It goes back to 1950, and it's widely open, since only the trivial case of dimension 1 is known. As for the asymptotic behavior of this number, it was proved to grow exponentially large. And this result is due to Frankel and Wilson as a consequence of the so-called intersection theorems proved in 1981. Much more recently, 2010, Frank Valentin and Fernando Mario de Oliveira Filho proved that gave another proof that the measurable chromatic number of Euclidean space grows exponentially large. And they use a completely different method that it extends the so-called Lovaas theta number to this problem. In this talk, I want to discuss the possibility to combine the two methods with the hope that the asymptotic growth will be as good as Frankel and Wilson result, and maybe, or why not, hopefully even better. So far we don't know about the asymptotic behavior, but we have already improvements in small dimensions that I will present. So the outline of the talk will be the following. We will start to discuss the chromatic number of Euclidean space and the story of the problem. Then we will review on Frankel and Wilson intersection theorems and consequences on the chromatic number of Euclidean space. And then we will discuss the theta light bound designed by Frank and Fernando. And then we will discuss the possibility to combine the approaches, and we will present numerical results in small dimensions. And this is based on joint work in progress with them. Okay, so let me repeat some definitions. So the chromatic number of Euclidean space is the smallest number of colors needed to color every point of the Euclidean space, such that two points at distance 1 receive different colors. So for the plane, this notion was introduced by someone called Nelson in 1950, while he was an undergraduate in Chicago University. And for the plane, it's widely open, as we shall see. For the line, it is obvious, as is shown by this picture, that two colors are enough and necessary to color the line. For the plane, the only thing that we know on this number is that it stands between 4 and 7, and these results were already known to Nelson and his colleague Isbell in 1950. And those bounds are rather easy to prove, and they are proved by those two pictures, actually on the left-hand side. We see a piece of a coloring of the plane with 7 colors. So how is it organized? It uses the tiling of the plane with hexagons. And then here you have a pattern of 7 hexagons. So 6 hexagons around the pink hexagon in the middle. And so they all receive different colors. And then this pattern is repeated all around the plane. And it is a suitable covering if the diameter of the hexagon are slightly less than 1, while the distance between two pink hexagons here is larger than 1. So of course it's not the only solution for a coloring with 7 colors. There are many other colorings that are possible, not using hexagons, but this one is a nice regular one. On the other hand, so this proves that the chromatic number of the plane is lower bounded by 7. On the other hand, if we consider this graph, which was discovered by the Moses brothers, it's called the Moses spindle, and we consider this graph as embedding in the plane such that the edge is half length 1, then a coloring of the plane will induce a coloring of this graph, of course, and it's not difficult to see that the chromatic number of this graph is equal to 4, so here you have a coloring with 4 colors. It's not difficult to see that 3 colors are not enough, so that the chromatic number of the plane should be at least equal to 4. And it's all what we know on this number, the chromatic number of the plane. So as we have seen with the Moser spindle, then for any finite graph which is embedded in Rn, in the sense that the edges have length 1, then the chromatic number of the Euclidean space is lower bounded by the chromatic number of the finite graph. So this is basically an inequality that is used to obtain lower bounds for the chromatic number of the Euclidean space. And moreover, as a consequence of a certain compacity result due to De Bruijn and Erdős, then the chromatic number of Euclidean space is actually exactly equal to the maximum over all finite graphs of the chromatic numbers of all the graphs which are embedded in Rn. So people have started to look for good sequences of graphs. Heisky has generalized the Moser spindles to every dimension. Also, Larman and Rogers gave a number of constructions, Frankel and Wilson in 1981, also Zekely and Forman in 1989. Erdős conjectured that the chromatic number of Euclidean space grows exponentially with dimension, and this was proved by the Frankel and Wilson constructions, 1981. Rygorowski in 2000 gave a slight improvement on this estimate, and it's so far it's the best known estimate for this number. So if we want to use this inequality here, so to estimate the chromatic number of Euclidean space from its finite subgraph, then we face the problem of estimating the chromatic number of a finite graph, of course. So let me introduce some vocabulary. The independence number of a graph is the maximum number of pairwise unconnected vertices. So it's the same picture as in Frank's talk here. The red vertices are here an independent set of the Petersen graph. And the independence number of this graph is equal to 4. Of course, every color class of an admissible coloring is an independent set. So we have that the chromatic number of the graph is lower bounded by the quotient of the number of elements, the number of vertices by the independent number of the graph. So now, in order to lower bound this number, we need to upper bound the independence number of the graph. So for instance, for the Moser spindle that we have already encountered, it's easy to see that the independence number is equal to 2. Every 3 vertices are not independent. So the chromatic number is lower bounded by 7 over 2, which shows that the chromatic number is at least equal to 4. So now we face the problem to upper bound the independence number of a graph. In fact, there are 2 general methods. Lovaas theta number, theta of G, on one hand, and on the other hand, the so-called linear algebra method, which was used by Frankel and Wilson for their graphs. So actually, we are facing a problem when we look at the chromatic number of the Euclidean space. We are, of course, trying to compute the chromatic number of an infinite graph with vertex set Rn and with edge set the pairs of vectors at distance 1. So its independent sets are the 1 avoiding sets, namely the sets S which do not contain pairs of elements at distance 1. And we would like to have a similar framework as before for this infinite graph. So the problem is that we have to substitute for the number of elements of an independent set some notion, and for the independence number some notion. Of course, we don't want to count the number of elements of an independent set in this infinite graph, but we will measure this set with some Lebesgue measure. So this requires S to be measurable, and so this introduces the notion of a measurable chromatic number. It will be easier to deal with because the independent sets, the associated dependent sets, are measurable. And the next problem will be to upper bound this number, this substitute for the independence number. Right, so the measurable chromatic number has the same definition as the chromatic number, except that we ask that the color classes are measurable. So Falconer in 1981 showed that the measurable chromatic number is at least equal to n plus 3. In particular, it shows that the chromatic number of the plane is at least equal to 5. So of course, the measurable chromatic number is at least equal to the usual chromatic number of the Euclidean space. And so it's an open question to decide whether these two numbers are different or not. So now I introduce the notion that replaces the independence number of a graph for the unit distance graph. So it will be called M1 of Rn. This is the supremum of the density of a measurable subset of Rn containing no pair of points at distance 1, so of 1 avoiding sets. And what is the density? The density of the set S is defined as usual by computing the volume of S intersected by a ball of radius R, say centered at 0, divided by the volume of the ball, and you take the limb sup over R going to infinity. So this will play the role of alpha of G for finite graphs. So not surprisingly, we have that the measurable chromatic number of Euclidean space is lower bounded by 1 over M1 of Rn. So this inequality replaces the inequality chi of G is lower bounded by number of vertices divided by alpha of G that we saw for finite graphs. And moreover, Larman and Rogers in 72 proved that M1 of Rn is upper bounded by the quotient alpha of G divided by the number of vertices of T for every finite graph which is embedded in Rn. So far, for a long time, this inequality was the only inequality used to upper bound this number. While Frank and Fernando introduced another upper bound, which uses a generalization of Lovaas theta number. So now we will review on Frankel and Wilson intersection theorems, which give actually the best lower bound for the chromatic number of Euclidean space. So their theorem go like that. So there are several parameters. So n is an integer, w is an integer which is less than half of n, q is a prime power, and q satisfies that q is between w over 2 and w. Now s is a subset of 0, 1 to the nw, so what is 0, 1, nw? 0, 1, nw is the set of binary vectors of length n with w ones. So in other words, it's the set of W subsets of a N subset. And S satisfies the property that for all U, V in S, then the intersection of U and V is not equal to W minus Q. So the intersections of elements of S avoid one value. Then they prove that the number of elements in S is upper bounded by the binomial coefficient n q minus 1. So some remarks. S in this theorem is an independent set for a certain graph. The graph with vertex set 0, 1, nw and with edge set the set of pairs with intersection equal to w minus q. So the theorem gives actually an upper bound for alpha of g for the independence number of this graph. The proof uses the so-called linear algebra method, and this bound is better than the upper bound that would be obtained with the Lovaas theta number upper bound for the independence number. So let us review the proof of that theorem. So the linear algebra method, it works always the same way. The steps are the following. To every element of S, we associate a certain element fu. So to U in S, we associate fu. We show that fu belongs to a certain subspace of dimension n choose q minus 1. And then we show that the FUs are linearly independent. And altogether, we have the bound that the number of FUs, which is the cardinality of S, is upper bound by this dimension. So here, FU is like that. FU of V is, so forget about this term for the moment, the product of these terms, so intersection of U and V, minus W plus L. And here, we run over all possible L from 1 to Q minus 1, but we avoid Q, which is the value of the intersection avoided by S. And because there are Q minus 1 terms here, FU fall into the subspace of functions of degree at most Q minus 1 over 0, 1, n, w. And this subspace has dimension n choose Q minus 1. And now, in order to prove that the FU are linearly independent, the prime power Q comes into play. It turns out that these functions take integral values. And moreover, when you take the matrix FU of V, when U and V run into S, then this matrix is congruent to the identity matrix mod P, where P is the prime divisor of Q. And this proves that these functions are linearly independent. So this is Frankel and Wilson intersection. So it's one among a whole family of intersection theorems that he proved, that they proved in their paper. But this is the one that is used for the chromatic number of Euclidean space. So actually, using the obvious embedding of the binary vectors in Rn, we see that the Euclidean norm of U minus V is computed as the value, so the square of this has the value 2W minus 2 times the intersection. So avoiding one intersection value means avoiding one distance. So now we can rescale the vectors so that this distance is equal to 1. And so now we can apply the inequality, the chromatic number of Euclidean space is lower bounded by the number of vertices divided by the independence number. So the number of vertices is n choose w, and the independence number is upper bounded from the theorem by this number. So now we have to choose the best, so for the asymptotic result, we have to choose the best w and the best q. So the best w is the minimum of 2q minus 1 and n over 2, and the best prime power q would run linearly with n. And if we optimize on alpha, we obtained the result here due to Frankel and Wilson that the chromatic number of Euclidean space is lower bounded by 1.207 to the n. And similarly for the number upper bound for m1 of Rn, of course. And Rai-Grotzky in 2000 managed to improve this result using vectors with 0, 1s, and minus 1s. With fixed number of ones and fixed number of minus ones, and he obtained this improvement on this number. So now the Lovaas theta number gives an upper bound for the independent set of a graph. So let us review on this notion. So the theta number was introduced by Lovaas in 1979. And it satisfies the so-called sandwich theorem, meaning that it is sandwiched between the independence number of the graph and the chromatic number of the complementary graph. It is the optimal value of a semi-definite program, so it is defined as follows. It's the maximum over all matrices which are indexed on the vertex set of the graph, which are positive semi-definite, which have trace 1, which have which coefficients corresponding to edges are equal to 0, and we take the maximum of the sum of all coefficients. So let us see why we have this inequality, alpha of g is less than theta of g. Actually, if S is an independent set of the graph g, then we can associate to S a matrix BS, defined by BS of xy is 1S of x, 1S of y divided by the number of elements of S. 1S is the characteristic vector of the set S. And then it's easy to see that this matrix satisfies all these conditions. So it's a feasible matrix for this program. And moreover, this double sum here for BS is equal to the number of elements of S. So we obtain the inequality that the number of elements of S is upper bounded by the Lovaas theta number. So two slides to explain what a semi-definite program is. Maybe it's unnecessary here, but never mind. So a semi-definite program, it's a convex optimization program with a primal form, which asks for the infimum of, so this bracket means the trace of the product of the matrices of A0Z over all positive semi-definite matrices Z that satisfy some linear constraints like AIZ equals BI for some I running from 1 to M. And to such a program is associated a dual program which has this form. So Lovaas theta has this expression here. And they generalize linear programs which occur when the matrices are diagonal. In general, gamma star is upper bounded by gamma, and the optimal value of every dual feasible is upper bounded by the optimal value over a primal feasible. Under some mild conditions, we have a strong duality, meaning that gamma is equal to gamma star. And moreover, we have good algorithms based on interior point methods to approximate the optimal value of a semi-definite program to an arbitrary precision in polynomial time. So in the case of strong duality, and moreover, there are free solvers available on the website NEOS. So now we want to introduce a generalization of the Lovaas theta number to the unit distance graph, which I repeat is the graph with vertex set Rn and edge set the pairs of vectors at distance 1. So this is based on work by Frank and Fernando, Fourier analysis, linear programming, and densities of distance ranging sets in Rn. And we will see that the resulting program turns to be explicitly computable. So how shall we do this? So I recall here the definition of the theta number for a finite graph. So the maximum of this expression over matrices which are indexed by the vertex set and are positive semi-definite. Okay, and satisfy this condition. So what shall we do? It's natural to replace the matrices indexed by the vertex set by functions over Rn, moreover continuous functions. And a matrix being positive semi-definite can be replaced by the notion of positive definite functions. So we will do this. And for this objective function, the double sum, of course, we will replace this by some sort of integral. So we take the continuous positive definite. What does it mean? It means that for all choice of the integer k and all choice of k points in Rn, then the finite matrix defined by B of xi xj is positive semi-definite. So this notion of continuous positive definite functions has been extensively studied in harmonic analysis. So it's a standard notion. Moreover, we will assume that B is translation invariant, meaning that B of xy is some function f of x minus y, and this is quite natural if we think of the graph, the unit distance graph, itself is invariant by translation. If two points are distance 1, and the translated points are, again, at distance 1, of course. And because we aim at the density of a distance 1 avoiding set, then we will replace this double sum here by the density of the function f. So what will be the density of the function f? It's the average value of f over a ball of radius r, and then we let r tend to infinity. And then we end up with this program. This supremum over densities of F, where F is continuous bounded on Rn, positive definite, and satisfy F of 0 is 1, and F of x is 0 when x has norm 1. And then the theorem is that this number upper bounds M1 of Rn. Then in order to solve this linear program here, infinite dimensional linear program, we use Bochner characterization of positive definite functions. Namely, he proved that the continuous functions which over Rn, which are positive definite, are Fourier transform of non-negative measures. And so we have this expression for F. And moreover, I claim that we can assume F to be radial, which means that F is invariant under the orthogonal group. Why is it so? Let's go back to the program. This program is actually invariant by the orthogonal group. So if F is a feasible function, then the F transformed by an element of the orthogonal group will be again feasible. So if F is an optimal function, then the average of F over the orthogonal group will be again optimal. So we can assume that F is invariant under the orthogonal group. And now F being invariant under the orthogonal group here means that F is equal to the average value of F when we let the orthogonal group act on this. And this turns F into this expression here. So F has this integral expression for a non-negative measure alpha and for omega n, which is this function. So this is the Bessel function with parameter n over 2 minus 1 and modified by a power of t. So now we have this program, this expression for the crop program. It's the supremum of alpha of 0, where alpha is a non-negative measure of integral over the interval 0 plus infinity of total measure 1, and that satisfies that the measure of omega n of t, the integral of omega n of t, against alpha is equal to 0. And now we take the dual program of this. It's almost there, and here is the dual program. So it's now the infimum over z0, where z0 and z1 are real variables. So z0 plus z1 should be greater or equal to 1, and z0 plus z1 times omega n of t should be greater or equal to 0 for all t, for all non-negative t. So now it's only two variables, linear program, of course, with infinitely many conditions here, but it can be solved very easily. Let me show how it works for dimension 4. So this is a plot of this omega 4 function here. So it takes value 1 at 0, and then it oscillates around 0, closer and closer to 0 here. So we are looking for a function of the form z0 plus z1 omega 4 of t, and we want it to be non-negative, okay? So what can we do on omega 4? We can translate it, and then we scale it. So we would translate omega 4 up so that it becomes non-negative, and then we will rescale it so that it takes the value 1 at 1, and we obtain this function. So we translate this function until the minimum here reaches 0, and then we rescale so that it takes the value 1 at 0. And that's indeed the optimal. And it's well known that the minimum of omega n of t here, this number, is reached at j n over 2 1, which is the first 0 of the Bessel function j n over 2. So this value here. And now we obtain this expression for the optimal function and this expression for the optimal value. So the resulting bound is like that, and it decreases exponentially but not as fast as Frankel-Wilson-Rygotsky bound. So 1.165 to the minus n instead of 1.239 to the minus n. So to summarize, we have seen two essentially different bounds for the number m1 of Rn, so the maximum density of a one avoiding set in Rn, namely the bound coming from alpha of g divided by the size of vertex set, jointly with Frankel and Wilson graphs, and jointly with the linear algebra method bound for the independence number on one hand, and on the other hand, the theta number of Rn as defined by Frank and Fernando, which more or less encodes the theta number of every embedded graph in Rn. So now I want to discuss the possibility to combine the two methods. And what do I mean by combining the two methods? We will end up with a program which is slightly more complicated here, and which takes account of a finite graph G in R embedded in Rn. And for, so Ri will be the norm of the vertex number I of the graph G. So now the new program is the following. Theta G is the infimum. So now we have three variables instead of two. Of this optimal value, z0 plus z2 times alpha of g divided by size of v over z0, z1, z2, satisfying these conditions. So z2 should be non-negative, z0 plus z1 plus z2 should be greater or equal to 1. And we have this condition that this function should be non-negative. So here we should notice that if z0 is equal to 0, then we recover the old theta of Rn. Right. So it actually contains theta of Rn as a special case. And we have the following theorem that M1 of Rn is upper bounded by theta G of Rn, which is itself upper bounded by theta of Rn. So let us give some argument for this. So as I said before, theta G is less than theta because theta is recovered by taking z2 equals to 0. And now I briefly sketch a proof of the inequality M1 is less than theta G. So if S is a measurable set avoiding 1, then we associate a function to S, Fs, defined by this expression, Fs of x is equal to the density of the product 1s minus x, 1s, so 1 is the characteristic function of the set, divided by the density of S. So this plays a role of the function that was associated to an independent set for finite graphs and for Lovaas theta number, which was 1 over number of elements of S, 1 S of X, 1 S of Y. So it's very similar. And Fs turns out to be continuous bounded, positive definite, and satisfy S, Fs of 0 is 1, Fs of X is 0 if X has norm 1. So this function actually is feasible for theta. And the density of Fs is the density of S. So with this function, we prove already that M1 of Rn is less than theta of Rn. So now we want to inject the graph G in the into play. So this is done here. So if V, the vertex set, is the set of points x1, xm, then we have this obvious inequality that the sum of 1s minus xi of y is less than alpha of g. This is very easy to see. And this leads to the extra condition that the sum of fs of xy is less than alpha of g. So now we add this constraint, which is linear, to the program that defines the theta number. And so we have designed a linear program, infinite dimensional one. And now we go the same line, apply Bochner theorem that characterizes the positive definite functions, and then symmetrize over the orthogonal group, and then take the dual. and we end up with this expression for theta g. So now the problem is that we can replace g by any graph which is embedded in Rn. But the problem is that this new linear program cannot be solved explicitly, or at least we don't know how to do it. So we can only solve it numerically. So bad news is that the theta g of Rn apparently cannot be solved explicitly. So the challenge now is to compute some good feasible functions for this program. And the first method we can think of is to sample a certain interval 0m and then solve a finite linear program. So consider only the conditions that the function at the points is non-negative for sampling of this interval. And then look at the optimal solution obtained by this sampling and then adjust it. And this was already done in Frank and Fernando paper using the simplex graph, actually. And so if we look at the optimal solutions, that define with this method, so the blue solution is the optimal solution we have already seen for the theta number. And the red solution is the optimal solution for theta g for n equals 4 and for the simplex. And so if we look closely at those two graphs, we can see that the zero here, the point at which the function is equal to zero, which was the g n over 2, 1, right, the first zero of the Bessel function, has slightly moved to the right. So the new optimal function still has a zero, but it's slightly moved to the right. So now the observation is this. And so the idea is that we can try to parameterize the function z0 plus z1 omega nt plus z2 omega n of rt. So here I assume that the graph stands over, for simplicity, I assume that the graph stands over a sphere of radius r. And so we can think of parameterizing those functions with the zero y. So with y such that f of y is equal to, so it should be a double zero, is equal to the derivative of f of y is equal to zero. And moreover, we want f of zero equals to one. And in fact, these conditions uniquely determine f as a function of y. So more precisely, we can solve for these conditions. So this translates the fact that f of zero is one, this translates the fact that f of y is zero, and this translates the fact that f prime of y is zero. And then we can solve for z0, z1, z2, and obtain an expression for f depending on y. And then we can numerically, we can start with this zero, which was the zero of the optimal solution of theta, and then move y step by step to the right until the function takes negative values. So we move to the right, and while the function remains positive, and we see what's going on for the objective value, and it turns out that the objective value is decreasing more and more. So that's basically the numerical method that I have used to compute these numbers. So these are the numerical improvements obtained so far. So the first column is the upper bound for M1 of Rn obtained without graph, meaning the theta of Rn upper bound and the corresponding lower bound for the measurable chromatic number. So this is extracted from Frank and Fernando numerical results with simplex. And so the simplices give an improvement on these numbers from dimension 2. up to dimension 24, but after dimension 24, they don't give any more improvements. And it leads to those lower bounds for the measurable chromatic number. And these are the upper bounds obtained for M1 of Arrhenius with Frankel and Wilson graphs. More precisely, it's not exactly Frankel and Wilson graphs. It's Frankel and Wilson graphs, but embedded in Rn with plus ones and minus ones instead of zeros and ones. Yes, exactly. And it's also projected one dimension less because the sum of the coefficients is constant up to 28. So the four last lines do not take account of the projection. And I start dimension 15 because it's the first dimension where this method gives an improvement on the previous. And so the game here was to see if we can go far for the dimension n, and if the improvement remains. It seems to be the case, and it seems to increase quite nicely. But we are only at dimension 50, so we cannot really conclude if the improvement is asymptotic or not. So to end the talk, some questions and comments. So of course, the open question that we don't know how to answer yet is, what is the exponential behavior of this modified theta using the Frankel and Wilson graphs? There is room for improvement for small dimensions, of course, because the Frankel and Wilson graphs are not the optimal graphs for small dimensions. They are asymptotically the optimal known, the best known graphs, but not for small dimensions. Also, we can consider several graphs, which increases the number of variables of the program. And the consideration of several graphs was already used by Frank and Fernando, especially for dimension 2. They use several triangles, leading to this value. And even more recently, Fernando computed the linear program with several Moser spindles. And this gives this number, which is the current record for an upper bound for M1 of R2. The open question for dimension 2 would be, can we reach M1 of R2 less than 0.25? So this is conjectured by Erdős, and it would give another proof that the measurable chromatic number is larger than 5, which would be nice. All this stuff applies to other spaces, especially to the maximum density of subsets of the sphere, of the unit sphere, avoiding one angle. So over Rn, of course, avoiding one distance is equivalent to avoiding distance 1. For the sphere, the value of the angle makes sense. So every angle is a different story, so to say, for this number. So the theta approach was already developed in a joint work, myself, Gabriel Nebel, Fernando Oliveira, and Frank Valentin, 2009. But we didn't include the graphs, finite graphs constraints, but this could be done here. And also the challenge would be that if we can improve the known upper bounds for m of Sn minus 1 theta for some theta, we can in turn re-inject these upper bounds for theta of Rn by replacing the upper bound alpha g divided by the number of elements of v by a new upper bound coming from this. So in other words, we need not take finite graphs here, but we could take, say, a sphere, for instance. So the Lovaas theta method was successfully adapted to Rn, as I explained. What about the linear algebra method? Could we use the linear algebra method directly to upper bound M1 of Rn? So this question was raised by Gilles Kelly on his blog. So the linear algebra method is already used on the sphere for a set of points with a finite number of of angles, but not for the set of points that avoid one angle. And that's all. Thank you for your attention.